Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Parker Malloy, publisher of the Present Age newsletter, who discusses Donald Trump and the Republican Party's attack on trans rights and the Democrats' disturbingly weak response to this assault on the transgender community. John Storr, editor of the Daily Politics newsletter, The Editorial Board, who assesses our nation's dangerous media landscape with the pervasive spread of right-wing disinformation and its corrosive impact on U.S. politics. And Chris Wellborn, president of the National Association of Defense Lawyers, who talks about the Last Chance campaign, urging President Biden to grant clemency to 80-year-old American political prisoner Leonard Peltier. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
During the pre-holiday congressional budget crisis, President-elect Donald Trump called on the Republican-controlled House to abolish the federal debt limit or at least delay it for 4 years. But House GOP budget hawks, joined by Democrats, defeated a move to waive the debt limit before backing a bipartisan bill that averted a government shutdown and extended funding for federal programs until mid-March next year. But with Trump's plan to renew and increase tax cuts for the rich and profitable corporations, public debt will soar and hurt low- and moderate-income families. The loss of government revenue due to tax cuts is the pretext right-wing politicians and the richest man on the planet, Elon Musk, will use to demand $2 trillion in cuts to government spending, targeting social safety net programs like Medicaid and food stamps, as well as dismantling the Affordable Care Act that benefits 45 million Americans. 75% of all Americans carry an average of $100,000 in debt, and most working people don't have savings to cover a $400 emergency expense. But as government cuts increase personal debt, In These Times reports that this can become a unifying issue that bonds disparate members of the working class and impoverished Americans together. Already, people organizing against unsustainable debt have been winning major gains for tenants, student loan and medical debtors, and union members. The growing frequency of climate change-fueled storms are putting flood-prone, low-lying areas and drought-stricken mountainous regions at risk of storm and wildfire damage. But growing climate risks are being largely ignored by the nation's two largest mortgage underwriters, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who back up half of all U.S. mortgages and keep real estate markets liquid. Fannie and Freddie, under federal conservatorship since the 2008 financial crisis, have reserve capital buffers, but large losses due to the climate crisis could force American taxpayers to bail them out. According to the Congressional Budget Office, federally backed mortgages are projected to suffer from $190 billion in flood damage over the next 30 years, not including the cost of wildfires and drought. Recurring extreme storm damage could undermine the economic viability of some regions as major employers leave and municipalities lose tax revenue, setting off a downward spiral. As the real estate industry resists pricing in climate hazards into mortgages, insurance companies continue to increase premiums, limit coverage, or withdraw from storm-ravaged markets altogether. The 940-mile Caspian Pipeline Consortium that has transported oil from Kazakhstan to a Russian port on the Black Sea since 2016 carried hopes for international cooperation as well as future profits for both state and corporate investors. The pipeline, one of the world's largest, was also conceived as a means to reduce Western dependence on Middle East oil. Chevron and ExxonMobil are among the pipeline's largest investors, making billions in profits annually. A 2-year investigation by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists exposes a pattern of problematic contracts and deals that illustrate how Western oil companies turned a blind eye to bribery risks, potential conflicts of interest, and cost overruns. The report also reveals how Western oil company money has empowered anti-democratic actors in Kazakhstan, enriching Vladimir Putin's Russia and regional elites. The pipeline, which is free of Western sanctions, has paid Russian state-controlled companies $816 million since the start of the war in Ukraine. Edward Chow, a former Chevron executive, responded to the investigation's allegations of oil industry corruption in Russia by saying it's not just the oil companies who were complicit, so was the U.S. government. He went on to charge that they all knew, or they should have known, but chose to look the other way. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Throughout his 2024 election campaign, Donald Trump focused on three main issues: the demonization of immigrants of color, defaming members of the transgender community, and his pledge to weaponize the government to exact retribution on his perceived political enemies. Despite Trump's record of pathological lies, divisive rhetoric, a 34-count felony conviction, inciting the violent January 6th Capitol insurrection, and being found liable for sexual assault, the real estate developer and former reality TV star was elected by a narrow margin on November 5th, but winning less than 50% of the vote. Although the national debate on transgender rights wasn't a top issue for most voters, Trump and the Republican Party spent $215 million alone on network TV ads that vilified transgender people, who make up just 1% of the U.S. population. For years now, opposition to trans rights has been a major focus of the Republicans' culture war. Since the beginning of 2023, GOP-governed states across the country have passed dozens of laws restricting trans people's options for gender-affirming medical care, sports participation, and public restroom access. The FBI's annual report on hate crimes for 2023, released in September, found incidents of crimes targeting Americans for their sexual orientation or gender identity rose to record numbers, even as violence in the nation overall continued to drop. Your reporter spoke with Parker Malloy, publisher of the Present Age newsletter. Parker, a trans person herself, talks about her recent article titled "One Day in Anti-Trans America," discussing government attacks on trans rights and the Democrats' disturbingly weak response to this assault on the transgender community.
You know, obviously Republicans thought that running explicitly against trans issues, you know, I mean, pretty much anyone who watches during the World Series or during NFL games, they were airing these ads nonstop that Kamala Harris cares for they, them, Donald Trump cares about you. That was kind of the message there. And it took shots at Harris for having basically in the past stood up for trans people's Eighth Amendment rights to avoid a cruel and unusual punishment in prison, having health care taken away. That became a giant topic. In the first month after the election, it was really interesting to see how Democrats were responding to that. I wrote a piece that was, I called it "One Day in Anti-Trans America." It was this piece that came about because I noticed something striking. On December 10th, three pieces of journalism dropped that, when viewed together, paint a devastating picture of what's happening with trans rights right now. You had Rolling Stone reporting on how Democrats might abandon trans healthcare protections when Trump returns to office, despite having the power to prevent it. The Marshall Project documented disturbing new policies in Florida prisons where trans women are being subjected to humiliating physical examinations. And HuffPost revealed how Republicans slipped an anti-trans health care restriction into the must-pass defense bill, essentially forcing military families to choose between their careers and their children's health care. So what struck me wasn't the volume of news, but how it showed the attacks coming from every angle. You had federal legislation, state policies, party politics. And while the reporting itself was excellent, the picture it painted was grim. We're seeing coordinated efforts to strip away trans rights through multiple channels simultaneously. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to highlight how good journalism helps us understand and fight back. Each of these reporters on each of those stories did the hard work of digging beneath surface level political rhetoric to show the real human impact of these policies, while also exposing how much of the justification for them relies on misleading claims and discredited research.
And Parker, I did want to ask you, in looking at the Democrats' response or non-response to the unbridled and vicious attacks on the trans community from the Trump campaign during the 2024 election, what are your concerns about the party's stance on human rights as it applies to the trans community?
Sure.
Because in a lot of the postmortem discussion about the election after Kamala Harris lost, there were some Democrats who said, you know, we just have to tamp down our advocacy for human rights when it comes to trans folks. And that was very concerning to hear.
Yeah, that was very concerning. I mean, I'm trans, and so this affects me personally. And it was really frustrating during the campaign to watch as you would have Trump going on the attack, smearing trans people just the same way he smeared other groups. You know, the same way Donald Trump went out there and accused migrants in Ohio of eating cats and dogs was the same way he smeared trans people. And unfortunately, Democrats didn't really respond to that. They sat quietly. When asked directly about the attacks, Kamala Harris in particular, she would just respond, "I will follow the law." It was not a particularly good defense of trans people. You know, she could have said medical decisions for trans people, for all people, should be left between a doctor and the patient. And if you're talking about someone who's a minor, you include their parents in the discussion as well. Those are the lines that she could have used but didn't. In the aftermath of the election, it's been frustrating to watch as some political strategists and just, you know, a lot of people on social media We'll sit there and go, you know, they just got to give up on this trans thing. But the truth is that Democrats haven't been running on trans rights. If you look for, you know, how much Harris talked about it during the campaign, the truth is that she didn't at all. It didn't come up. And other Democrats haven't been running on this as well. All that trans people want right now and what all that trans people have been pushing for is essentially the status quo. Because the question when it comes to what's going to happen when Donald Trump takes office is how far backwards things are going to go. This isn't a situation where we're talking about progress not going fast enough. We're talking about how to stop an extremely speedy reversal of trans rights.
That was Parker Malloy, publisher of the Present Age newsletter. Find a link to her recent article titled "One Day in Anti-Trans America" and related commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. There are many explanations why Donald Trump, despite his long history of lies, criminality, and inciting a violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, narrowly won the November 5th election. The reasons most often cited are the economically destructive post-pandemic spike in inflation, fear about the large number of immigrants crossing the southern border, crime, and omnipresent racism and misogyny. But one major factor that clearly impacted the outcome of the election was the pervasive spread of disinformation and misinformation that led large numbers of voters to accept false claims about the state of the country and the candidates' positions on major issues. A powerful decentralized right-wing network of propaganda platforms on social media, podcasts, and the internet, was wildly successful in driving large numbers of voters to believe in politically weaponized lies and wild conspiracy theories that influenced how they voted. A recent commentary by John Storr, editor of the Daily Politics newsletter, the editorial board, examined the power of this right-wing media apparatus, which he explained wasn't simply comprised of Fox News, Breitbart, Twitter, Joe Rogan, or TikTok, but rather all of them together, plus thousands of other sources that worked in tandem 24/7 to advance Trump and the Republican Party's agenda, to which progressives and Democrats have no counter. Your reporter spoke with Storr about the nation's dangerous media landscape and the corrosive impact it has on U.S. politics.
I think most of us who pay attention to politics or have paid attention to politics for 25 years or so, like myself, we're used to talking about politics in terms of liberal and conservative, in terms of left and right. And the thing that this election really showed me is that that thinking is upside down and backwards. It's just not helpful anymore. The true axis, and what I mean by, AXIS, that axis in politics is true-false. That's really what it is right now. And as a consequence of this right-wing media apparatus that we live in an age really similar to the Renaissance period where there's so many people who live in darkness. We live in an age of superstition and fear and tremendous ignorance. The right-wing media apparatus, being what it is, as I describe it in the piece, it just brings out what was already there. I mean, don't get me wrong, we've always had ignorant people, right? And it doesn't make people ignorant, but it reinforces their ignorance, right? It justifies their ignorance. It arouses their ignorance in such a ways that, just enough people in just enough places believe just enough of the lies. About Kamala Harris, about the Democrats, period, about reality. I mean, we don't have the right-wing media apparatus is so big. There are people in this country, millions of people, who can inhabit a reality that's very distinct and different from the one I live in, from the one you live in. And the fact is that people who understood the facts to the best of their ability, they tended to vote for Kamala Harris. And people who believed lies tended to vote for Donald Trump. And that's the true axis in American politics right now.
John, briefly describe what we're up against in terms of a media system on the right that very successfully has a conveyor belt of lies that it's mainstreaming through podcasts, social media, and a lot of other avenues that really evade any kind of fact-checking, where investigative reporting revealing corruption and malfeasance is totally absent. Tell us a little bit about that system and what you think we have to do as responsible journalists and people with political interests in moving the country forward. What do we have to do to build an effective counter to it?
We need to stay focused on the effective counter, and there is none right now. A lot of us sit around, hoping that the Republicans will stop being terrible. They're not going to stop being terrible. There are a lot of us sitting around hoping that the mainstream media will do its job and live by its own principles. This really is probably not going to happen. We've saw it with the Washington Post and the LA Times, and now most recently with ABC News caving to Donald Trump. We probably can't have much hope in them. So what do we do? We need to look to the Democrats and get them to see that they really need to step up. They need to find the money. They need to find people. They need to make the connections and start creating their own media apparatus. You don't need to lie. You actually propagandize the truth. That's basically what you need to do. You need to speak for the truth, to speak for facts. Right now, Democrats are in this bad habit of saying to themselves, well, the facts are out there and people will come to their own conclusions. No, absolutely not. The Republicans never let anybody come to their own conclusions. Then they will lie to achieve those purposes. What Democrats need to do is speak for the facts and push people toward conclusions by way of the truth and toward good policy and so on and so forth.
Is there any evidence that that's happening, that people within the Democratic Party or the left in general, and we're talking about labor unions too, understand Yes. that the future of the country really relies on combating a disinformation system that is succeeding in changing the outcome of elections?
There is movement now of some people taking it very seriously. There are three people right now who are vying to be the chair of the Democratic National Committee. And all three of them, from what I can tell, really understand this problem very well. One is Ken Martin from Minnesota. The other is Martin O'Malley from Maryland. And the best one, I think, is Ben Wickler. He's out of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I think there is some movement in that direction. We'll see where it goes.
That was John Storr, editor of the Daily Politics newsletter, The Editorial Board. Find a link to his recent article titled "Kamala Harris Wasted Money on Campaign Ads, Not Beyonce," and related commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On December 1st, President Joe Biden pardoned his son Hunter for any crimes he may have committed. On December 12th, the outgoing president granted clemency, consisting of 39 pardons and 1,499 commutations. Commutation reduces a sentence, totally or partially, that is then being served, but doesn't change the fact of conviction, imply innocence, or remove civil penalties. Just before Christmas, Biden announced that he was commuting the death sentences of 37 of the 40 men on federal death row to life in prison without the possibility of release. One petition the president hasn't acted on yet is commuting the two life sentences that American Indian Movement activist Leonard Peltier is serving after being convicted of aiding and abetting the murder of two FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota in 1975. Peltier, who's been in prison for 5 decades, has always maintained his innocence. No direct evidence tying him to the crime was introduced at his trial. Two other AIM activists were acquitted of murder almost 50 years ago after claiming self-defense. Now the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers has added its voice to scores of organizations and individuals around the world who are calling on Joe Biden to release Peltier, 80 years old and in poor health, so he can spend any remaining days at home with his family. The group recently sent a letter to President Biden seeking clemency for Peltier. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Chris Wellborn, president of the National Association of Defense Lawyers, about why his group decided to take up Peltier's case.
It is in our wheelhouse. This is the first time that I'm aware of we have called for a commutation of his sentence or clemency for him particularly, although our organization has been, in terms of members, involved in and interested in Native Americans and the intersection between Native Americans and the criminal legal system. This is something that has been one of the cornerstones of my presidency, and we have been involved in for years. We had members, well, specifically William Kunstler, who was involved in the defense of two of the three people tried for the murders of the FBI agents at Oglala.
And they were acquitted.
They were acquitted after the trial. That is correct. We've had other members who for years defended Native Americans, both in state and federal court throughout the country.
So I imagine that you've been following this case, whether you personally or your organization, and he's been in prison for almost 50 years. And there have been many efforts led by Indigenous people, but also, you know, Amnesty International, many, you know, the popes, many individuals and organizations around the world have been calling for decades, basically, because
we all know that his trial was rife with racism and prejudice, including perjured testimony, intimidation of witnesses, and the bullet casings found at the scene of the murders didn't match Leonard's gun, among other things.
But regardless of whether or not were he to have been given a fair trial where witnesses hadn't been intimidated, where you didn't have the overlay of everything that had gone on at Pine Ridge leading up to the shootout and He's been in jail 50-something years, well, almost 50 years. He's in terrible health. There are people who, quite frankly, have also been convicted of similar offenses. And, you know, it's just, it doesn't serve any purpose to keep him there.
Since he's been in jail for so many decades and people have been calling for his, you know, commutation for so long, why now? Why is your organization calling for this now?
Partially is because of his health issues and his age. And the basic idea is that if it doesn't happen now, it may never happen and he may die in prison. And the idea is that at this point, for him to be able to leave a federal facility, go back to, I believe it's Turtle Mountain, where he's from, seems like the humane way to resolve something that should have never happened back in, you know, the 1970s. The whole scenario of how that whole event took place and the events leading up to it was just one big unnecessary fiasco. And I don't in any way mean to minimize the death of these two agents, which is terrible for them and for their families.
Was this a letter that you wrote directly to the president?
Yes. Well, there were two letters. There was the letter that came from our organization, signed by me as president on behalf of the organization, that went directly. And then there was a letter that was co-authored that was basically our organization supporting some folks that had been advocating for his release for some time.
So 10,000 defense lawyers seems like a fairly hefty group.
Well, we hope. We hope. I mean, it's if you don't ask, you don't get. And it may turn out that Leonard Peltier is not granted clemency, but we're at least making the effort.
If Biden doesn't do that, are you going to continue your organization's advocacy into incoming President Trump's term?
That I certainly hope so.
That was Chris Wellborn, president of the National Association of Defense Lawyers. Learn more about the campaign urging President Biden to grant Leonard Peltier executive clemency by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky and Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WPPM in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, WFMP in Louisville, Kentucky, KBCS in Bellevue, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.